Let me say that I'm so happy that you had to read it and not me. First, I just want to say it's such a wonderful honor to be here with you this morning, and I thank you for this invitation. It's nice to be in a warm spot from the great state of Minnesota. You sure betcha. And I actually grew up in Westchester, so I'm a Pennsylvanian by heart, and went to school just down the road in Allentown at Muhlenberg. Living in the Midwest for so long, I forgot what it's like to get completely turned around on these curvy roads and the rolling hills. So it feels good to be back, actually. So when Wayne asked me to preach this morning and informed me that you were using the Do You See This Woman series from the Mennonite Women in Leadership Project, I was delighted. And then when he indicated that this week's section would be writing relationships and asked whether I would be okay working with that theme, I thought, oh, great, no problem. Sounds terrific. And then several weeks later, it occurred to me that I should probably read the text for this morning's service in order to start preparations. They are big texts. In Exodus, there is Miriam's victory dance as she saw the Egyptians and their horses and chariots washed up dead on the seashore after being swallowed up in the Red Sea. The Israelites have escaped bondage, and Miriam led the women in their celebration. Sing to the Lord, for he has triumphed gloriously. Horse and rider he has thrown into the sea. And the other text is the story of the judge Deborah as she leads her people into war against their oppressors. They slay all of Sisera's army, and Sisera himself ends up dead, done in by Jael, who hammers a stake into his temple while he's sleeping and assumes that he is safe. It is gruesome stuff, especially for an Anabaptist. I guess this is a warning to all my fellow procrastinators, and you know who you are. If Wayne sends you an email asking you to preach, make sure you check the text before you say yes. Well, with our nation's expanding military budgets, promises of vicious political retaliation, and an outsized arrogance about our status in the world, it hardly seems like an appropriate time to be looking towards texts that celebrate the death of opponents or delight in victory dances that revel in the spoils of violence. I mean, even the National Football League has a rule against excessive celebration. At times, the organization that I direct, the Brethren Mennonite Council for LGBT Interests, is itself accused of being militant. I never know quite how to respond to that charge. It feels so irrational and incongruous to me in terms of the actual experience of our lives, but it shows up. Pink Menno has particularly come under fire as being militant and even, I've heard, violent in its actions. Pink Menno is a marvelous young adult-led grassroots movement for LGBTQ inclusion within the Mennonite Church that exploded onto the scene about 10 years ago. Given all that we have heard about church decline and the growing disinterest in institutional religion among young adults, it was kind of astonishing to me that so many young Mennonites would show up and step forward because They cared so deeply about their church and so desperately wanted it to be better. Yet for their efforts, they were often chastised and even vilified. The denominational executive declared that they were, quote, haunting the church by their actions and did what he could behind closed doors to minimize their impact. I suspect that you, as an LGBTQ welcoming community, are painfully aware of congregations or pastors who have taken seriously denominational calls to be in conversation with LGBTQ people, and through that engagement, found your way to an inclusive posture, only to find yourselves suddenly labeled as troublemakers, disruptors, problems. Pastors and whole congregations' commitments to Jesus, to the church, the claims of Scripture upon us have often been suddenly thrown into question simply because these pastors and congregations have dared to suggest that LGBTQ people have integrity and value to God and to the church. Invitations have been withdrawn, pastoral credentials have been threatened, and some conferences have even moved to expel whole congregations for simply welcoming queer members. Somehow, the mere act of a few queer-identified people standing up to assert the goodness of our lives, or some allies rising in solidarity, is greeted as some sort of menace that must be stopped immediately in order to prevent the whole church and maybe even all of Christendom from collapsing. The intensity of the response has always seemed, to me at least, to be a tad disproportionate to the actual threat. Yet we as LGBTQ people and allies are regularly charged with causing division, fraying relationships, inflicting harm, corrupting morality, distorting the gospel, and inciting disunity. And all of this in spite of the fact that the Mennonite Church has spent decades and decades regulating, judging, silencing, condemning, and expelling queer bodies from its midst in ways that I would suggest have been most un-Jesus-like. In his fascinating book called The Culture of Conformism, Patrick Colm Hogan makes the rather extraordinary claim that the impulse towards virtue, or the notion that our moral convictions have deep consequences for our individual behavior, is grossly overrated. While we have a deep emotional need to think of ourselves as behaving ethically and being fundamentally good people, Hogan claims that in actuality, most of our behavior is dictated by our social environment. And he writes, I quote, "The mass of society reserves particular scorn for anyone who tries to act according to moral principle. Indeed, they take special care to denounce him or her as morally reprehensible. For anyone who spurns social convention in order to abide by society's moral precepts is, as such, a forceful argument that the rest of society is not behaving morally, that its affirmation of principle is mere hypocrisy. Action according to moral principle is the most threatening form of nonconformism. The only way of undermining the effect of such a person's example, the disturbing implications of his or her action, is to brand him or her a hypocrite and reprobate. This was the attitude of the Athenians to Socrates or the Pharisees to Jesus." End quote. Action according to moral principle is the most threatening form of nonconformism. I suspect that is an insight that resonates strongly with Mitt Romney these days as he finds himself outside of his political party. Certainly, it was well understood by the early Anabaptists. Please understand that my intent here is not to simply point a cheap accusatory finger towards the church or our detractors in a self-righteous or condemnatory fashion. Rather, it is to acknowledge the immense difficulty of creating moral change that is genuine, lasting, and meaningful. What we are about as this welcoming movement is hard and tedious work. It demands much from us and challenges our capacity to absorb hurt, misunderstanding, and even at times, some hatred and violence. But I think that this is part of what it means to be committed to the possibility of liberation and right relationship. Vaclav Havel, a playwright and part of the Velvet Revolution that led to him becoming the president of a free Czech Republic, put it succinctly, "We must not be afraid of dreaming the seemingly impossible if we want the seemingly impossible to become a reality." Returning to our text, it strikes me that both Miriam and Deborah, as Jews, were part of a minority people, a minority culture within larger kingdoms and empires. Both lived in times when their people were experiencing oppression at the hands of a superior force and were despondent and hurting. They understood that there was something wrong in that system. In the midst of this, these three incredible women emerged to bring hope, strength, wisdom, and joy to the people of Israel. It seems this is often the case. In times of deep difficulty and need, space opens up for those who have been marginalized to offer their strengths and gifts and moral leadership. We know, for example, that corporate boards are more likely to promote women and minorities to top leadership roles when the organization is in crisis. Sadly, they often replace them with white men once the crisis has been resolved. Miriam, the sister of Moses and Aaron and the first female prophet, leads the women in the Song of the Sea as they sing and dance and celebrate their liberation from Egyptian enslavement. Interestingly, this is the only time in the Torah that Israeli women, so often just subsumed within the community, act as a separate body, and they come together to rejoice and sing. Centuries after Miriam, Deborah appears as a prophet and judge in Israel, which means that she had both an important religious and political role. With Barak as her general, she leads a military victory over Sisera, who led the armies of King Jabin of Canaan, who had 900 chariots of iron. As Deborah predicted, Sisera is brutally killed by a woman, Jael, and thus Israel wins an important battle that will lead to their final victory over King Jabin. It is violent and difficult to read, but also wily and effective as well. I am struck by these women. Their ingenuity, brazenness, courage, and fortitude. They are powerful and strong, active and engaged. They seize the moment and defy expectations. I recently went to see the movie Harriet. If you haven't seen it, it's a wonderful film to go and watch. And I was struck to note that she had that same kind of personality. Harriet Tubman was a woman with a purpose. She was tenacious, fearless, and convicted. She had passion and grit and was unwavering in her commitment to her people, to freedom, and to justice. I want to be like that. And even more, I want our church to be like that. To be a community that guides people to freedom, that sings and dances about liberation, that takes action against the forces of destruction and oppression, that risks for the sake of a better future for the most vulnerable, that breaks with the expected and calls surprising people into positions of leadership and change. I want our church to be that place where dignity is afforded to each person, where love is love is love, and together we dream the seemingly impossible in order to make it a reality. I have seen glimpses of this kind of church, mostly on a congregational level, and it is beautiful to witness. In a presentation at Episcopal Divinity School, the feminist lesbian theologian Carter Hayward said, "This was Jesus' work, to make God exist, to struggle for right relation with sisters and brothers, to imagine a God in whose relational image we truly are created for the purpose of struggling with one another to make God exist again, here and now." Percussy Mennonite, I want to thank you for taking on this work of Jesus, for joining this sacred struggle to make God exist again, here and now, for queer people, for our families, for this community, and for the larger church. I want to thank you for acting according to moral principle and offering a different vision of what it means to be a faithful community. This is the stuff of right relationship, of hope, of possibility, of purpose. In these kinds of settings, the fierce spirit of Miriam, Deborah, Jael, and Harriet has space to imagine and breathe and consider what is possible for this time, for these people, for this world that God so loves. Thank you for your sacred work. Because of congregations like yours, I have hope that even though we have stumbled and faltered in far too many ways, there exists the very real possibility that God is not yet finished with the Mennonite Church, nor with us. And for that I say, thanks be.